Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we are speaking with Ed Stasium, a music producer whose credits include Talking Heads, Living Color, Smithereens, Misfits, The Empty Hearts, Mick Jagger, and more. However, today we are going to talk to Ed all about his time with the Ramones. Ed was in the recording studio with the Ramones for most of their greatest work, not only recording and producing, but playing on the records too. Join us today as we talk about what it was like being in the recording studio with the Ramones, the stories behind the albums we love, the insane shenanigans that happen when Phil Spector is in charge, and much, much more. And this week's episode is brought to you in part by GrooveWasher.com. All those old Ramones LPs you have will sound even more awesome if they're clean. Get yourself the world's best manual record cleaner, starting at $30 from GrooveWasher.com. And also make sure you pick up a stylus cleaning brush while you're at it. Those things work brilliant. Grab one today at GrooveWasher.com. And with that, let's talk to Ed Stasium all about his time with the Ramones.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All right, that's me. Hey, everyone. I am back in the saddle again. It's good to be back. All right, my comfy chair here in my basement and my cup of coffee. Hope everyone's doing okay. I took a week off the show. Did you miss me?
Well, I missed you. Oh, yes, I missed you.
No, I always miss talking records, but putting these episodes together each week, it does take quite a bit of time, so it's good to have a breather now and again. Besides, I figured there's plenty of episodes for you guys to catch up on, plenty of stuff. I mean, the Vinyl Guide, we started off the year with Joe Satriani right out of the gate, then Jake Burns of Stiff Little Fingers, then Derek Shulman of Gentle Giant, and then episode number 109, Moon Unit Zappa, talking all about what it was like growing up Zappa. Four heavy hitters right out of the gate. So I didn't feel guilty about taking a week off. During my time off, I went to see Pussy Riot, and that was an amazing show. If you don't know much about Pussy Riot, Google them now, perhaps on a non-work computer, and check out the documentary called A Punk Prayer. Essentially, these girls were jailed in Russia for protesting their government's policies, and they did it through impromptu punk performances at key Moscow locations, including a Moscow cathedral. They have way more courage than I have, that is for sure. And Pussy Riot recently had a performance in Sydney, which I saw, and then I met with one of the band members, Maria Alekhina, afterward. I posted a picture on Instagram, and then I got heaps of messages from people who thought perhaps we'd done an interview, which I need to let you know we have not. We did not do a Pussy Riot interview. I'd love to make that happen one day, but that night I was just there as a supporter and a music fan. But wow, how brave are they? Check out the documentary, A Punk Prayer. It's pretty incredible what this band did. And then on just one non-vinyl record-related topic, last week I had the incredible honor of running with the Commonwealth Games baton. So, you know how the Olympics have the torch and people run with it all around the world before the games? Well, the Commonwealth Games have something similar, what they call the Queen's baton. Same sort of thing as the Olympic torch, only, you know, it's not on fire. And I was nominated to run with it, and it was pretty friggin' amazing. I only had this 200-meter stretch of road to run with it before I handed it off to someone else, but it was pretty wild, you know, pretty weird. I was surrounded all by police. You know, they made this perimeter around me so nobody could mess with me or anything. It was kind of like the Secret Service, you know, make this space around the president. Only it wasn't me they were protecting, but really the baton itself, which has been everywhere around the world. You know, people have been skydiving with it. It's, you know, it's pretty amazing what they do with this baton. So it was pretty cool. I posted a few pics on our Instagram if you want to see those. Normally, I just post pictures of records, but there were a few selfie-worthy moments in the last couple of weeks that I posted up there. So enjoy. Instagram.com/vinylguide. And I tell you, one selfie I'd like to get is with Ed Stasium, producer of the Ramones. And let's face it, he was practically a member of the band. Ed engineered, played on, and produced the band for about six or seven records, became close friends with all of them, was a confidant for the rest of their lives, and continues to keep their legacy alive and sounding great in the recent remasters of the Ramones LPs. Today, Ed talks all about that, the history with the band, the fun times, the weird times, the Phil Spector adventure, and what's happening next to the Ramones catalog. Plus, he touches on all his other work he's doing outside the Ramones, including The Empty Hearts, a band which features a friend of our show, Elliot Easton. Now, Elliot, as you know, the brilliant guitarist of The Cars and the man that I named my son after, he was on The Vinyl Guide episode number 96, and he talks about working with Ed, really considers him a fifth member of the band. And oddly enough, Ed and I also have one thing in common. We both produce the same band. Ed and I produce songs for a band called The Sugar Ponies out of San Francisco. Of course, his tracks sound far better than the ones I worked on, but you could always judge for yourself. You could check them out at sugarponies.com. And with that, let's get into our conversation, a deep dive into the world of the Ramones with producer, musician, and all-around good guy, Ed Stasium. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we are talking with Ed Stasium, and we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into his time with the Ramones. Ed, how did you first start working with the band?
It's through Tony Bon Jovi. Earlier in my career, I had an association with Tony in the first studio I worked at, Venture Sound, and he was partners with Tony Camello at Venture Sound in New Jersey, which was the first studio I worked at. Tony and Tony had some kind of breakup, as lovers do. and I fell into place at Venture Sound engineering. Years later, I was in New York doing a telethon with Geraldo Rivera. There was a big scandal on Long Island. Anyway, Geraldo came up with these benefits to help these kids out. And I ran into Tony Bon Jovi, and he asked me to join the staff at going to be Power Station. At the time, I was living in Canada, working at Le Studio More in Heights, and I moved back to start up this new studio. And one of the first projects that I worked on was the Ramones' Leave Home. Tommy Early, had worked with Tony at Record Plant. And they did not want to work with Craig Leon again on the second record. And the only other producer that Tommy knew was Tony Bon Jovi. So I was part of the package. When I came back from Canada, I moved back to New Jersey, actually, and was put on staff on a salary, even though we knew we were going to build a studio, but the building had not been found. Nothing. We were just searching for studios, and I was working with Tony on projects, and that's how I was introduced to the Ramones.
So the Ramones at that point, it sounds like they were just another client of the Power Station.
It wasn't Power Station yet.
Oh, okay.
There was no building. It was the idea was to build a new studio in Manhattan, and I had joined the staff. I was asked to join. It was myself, Tony Bon Jovi, Bob Walters, who was the then manager of Media Sound, Bob Clearmountain, who is still at Media Sound, and Ed Evans, who is at Media Sound. I was the only independent they brought in. Tony, Bob, and Ed were still at Media Sound. So this was probably a year before we even started putting Power Station together. So we did leave home at a little studio called Sundragon.
Were you familiar with the Ramones up to then?
Not at all. I was living in Canada. I was up in the Great White North listening to Sham FM being bombarded by the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac and Linda Ronstadt.
And what was your reaction when you heard the Ramones?
When I heard that, I was like, whoa, I like this. It was great. It was rock and roll. It's the fresh injection of rock and roll that it needed at that time, instead of listening to prolonged solos and prog rock, back to basics, back to the roots. It was grand. And we all got along great. You know, we were all kind of, you know, brats from they were from Queens. I was from New Jersey. High school, we all went to high school, but I went to art school, but you know, it was the continuation of kind of street kid kind of thing.
How does one produce the Ramones?
Put up a few mics and record them.
Simple as that.
And guide through it. Of course, you know, I was brought in. Well, Tony actually said I was going to co-produce it with him, but when the record came out, I found out that I had engineering credit. Tony, you know, Tommy was really the producer on those records, with me. You know, we were. Tony was hardly there. He was off doing things, hustling, whatever he does. And Tommy and I made the records, and you know, just they were well rehearsed when we got into the studio, knocked off the tracks, and for Leave Home, the first record, probably knocked off the backing tracks in a day and a half, something like that. And then double track Johnny's guitar, did a couple of guitar overdubs, did the vocals, and then mixed it. It was pretty simple. There was not a lot. There was no additional arrangements. There was no guidance needed, which is, you know, great for a rock band, mm-hmm. which is the way it should be. You know, you shouldn't be dictating to the Ramones. It has to be this way. You know, you just try to bring their vision to fruition.
Right. So they had their songs ready to go. They didn't really need to spend much time, you know, screwing around in the studio or experimenting. They knew what they wanted.
Not at all. We didn't do any experimenting or taking our time and stuff until, you know, Road to Ruin, really. That's when that was the big, you know, spending the summer in the studio experimenting with Tommy and myself mostly.
Mm-hmm. And after Leave Home, there was Rocket to Russia. In between the mm-hmm. albums, did you have much socialization with the Ramones? Did you hang out with them at the clubs? Did you do anything with the tour, or it was largely just in the recording studio?
In the studio, you know, a couple of CBGB's gigs. I was working on numerous projects at the time, you know, so numerous I probably don't even remember. I mean, Tony was doing a lot of disco stuff, which I despised, actually, and it was very difficult for me to work on, but it was work. And it was, you know, and also Talking Heads came up in between there as well, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. And we did go into the studio in between Leave Home and Rocket to Russia to record Sheena. Sheena is a punk rocker. When Seymour heard the song when they played it live, he said, got to get into the studio. So he went to the studio and did Sheena and the B-side, I Don't Care, in a couple days. But there was really no socialization. You know, I didn't have any social life back then. I was working all the time.
So Sheena as a punk rocker was not originally designed to be part of an album or part of a collection. It was a single that they wanted to release just because Seymour thought it was a great song.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yep, it was a single. We went in and did it as a single. It was released as a single.
Now, I guess famously, it came back to appear on a repress of Leave Home in a replacement of the Carbona Not Glue track. A backstory for folks who may not know this. Again, Ed, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the Ramones recorded a song, Carbona Not Glue, for Leave Home, but Carbona was actually the name of a corporation. It's a licensed trademark, I believe, and they mm-hmm. pulled it off of early pressings because they were fearing a lawsuit.
That is correct.
So was there truly legal action, or were they just kind of spooked for the potential of a lawsuit?
I don't believe there's any legal action, none that I know of. Mm-hmm. The story I got was that the record company was afraid that there would be legal action, so they pulled it and replaced it with Sheena.
So Sheena eventually became part of the Leave Home package.
Became part of the Leave Home package, and it was also on Rocket to Russia. You know, it wasn't on the original vinyl issue of Leave Home. But, you know, later on, later issues, all these reissues that we're putting out now do have Carbona on them. Mm-hmm. And Sheena is on the, which we remixed whilst doing Rocket to Russia. That version is on Rocket to Russia.
Do the Ramones have a lot of outtakes, extra tracks, or do they work at all really lean?
We did it lean. We found some stuff. It's available on the box sets that I've been curating. We found quite a few things that demos and different versions. Actually, on the Rocket to Russia box set that came out in November, when I received the multi-tracks in the middle of last year, I found two tracks that I, you know, didn't even remember had existed. We actually cut a different version of I Don't Care for the Rocket to Russia record, but we used the B-side version that we cut at the same time as Sheena on the actual record, the original record of Rocket to Russia. So there's a bonus track of this, a different version of I Don't Care on the Rocket to Russia box, as there is a different version of It's a Long Way Back to Germany, which was also recorded for Rocket to Russia, wasn't used, and then we recut it to put on Road to Ruin later on. So we're finding bits and pieces here and there of stuff. But there was, to answer your question, there wasn't a lot of extra stuff cut.
Did you get the impression that when they were recording Leave Home and Rocket to Russia, these were songs that they had for a long time, or were they pretty fresh for the band?
They had written all of the songs for the first two albums before they went in for the first record. So all of the songs for Leave Home were already written previous to the first album. They had, like the 20 some odd songs ready to go and picked out the ones that they had on the first album. Then when it was time for the second record, they already had all those songs written.
Now, you briefly touched on the reissues that you're doing as of late, and I believe the Rocket to Russia and Leave Home 40th anniversary box sets, which is kind of a complete view. What is the difference between the original mixes and what is called the Ed Stasium mixes?
Well, we didn't name them Ed Stasium mixes there. On Leave Home, it was just basically a new mix. I was never really happy. We did that mix very, very quickly, and there was not a lot of definition in the drums, and there was a lot of reverb, and the guitars were split really, really wide left and right. And I over the years, I Tommy and I and the band, we had discussed actually, that we discussed that we weren't happy with those mixes. So on Leave Home, I just brought more definition to the drums, didn't use as much of the double track guitar, kind of made it a little bit more mono-ish and in your face. There's way less reverb on it. It's still the elements that we used, all the backing vocals and guitar overdubs and percussion that we used on the original mix. It was just a little more, it's a bit more refined and, like I said, in your face. Mm-hmm. For Leave Home. So it's the same elements in the mix. It's nothing drastically different. It's just refined, and there's more clarity to it and less wash, way less reverb. We are, for some reason, I was, we were on a real reverb kick back there, and whenever we mixed that in, 75, 76. Now with Rocket to Russia, when I got the multi-tracks, we had recorded Rocket to Russia at Media Sound. We did Sundragon was a tiny little studio. It was a box, basically. And there was no room for any ambient microphones. It was 16-track. When we went to do Rocket to Russia, it's 24-track. And I was able to finally put room mics into the picture. I didn't know anything. I basically learned how to record by myself. Didn't go to school, didn't have anybody teaching me. I didn't apprentice. I didn't learn from anybody. I kind of picked it up on my own. And from what I saw in a couple of studios that I had been in And when I was working at Le Studio More in Heights, I had the opportunity to work with the great Roy Thomas Baker. It was right when Queen were peaking with A Night at the Opera. And he was doing a band called Pilot. And myself and Nick Blagona, the other engineer, he was the chief engineer at Le Studio More in Heights. We were co-engineering this Pilot record. And the gear came in previous to the band and Roy coming in. And we had set up the drums in the drum booth, as was kind of stock practice in those days. You had a drum booth and tried to isolate everything, and everything was dead sounding, and you put carpeting on the frickin' drums, for God's sake. And when Roy came in the following day, he said, "Oh, what are those drums doing in that little booth back there? Let's put them out in the main room." So we moved them into the room, and he wanted me to put up room microphones, which I'm like, room microphones? What the fuck? I had no clue. And that inspired me to start using, crazy. He would mic the back of cabinets and, put a mic up down the hall from where the guitar speaker cabinet was. All these great things that, I'd never thought of doing. Mind you, I had only been doing it for, 4 years at that time as well. And, a little studio in New Jersey. And where we blanketed everything up, literally putting moving blankets over guitar amps so it wouldn't bleed into anything else, and putting the drums in a drum booth, and it was all about the separation. And with Roy, it was all about the ambient sound and bleed. So when I couldn't use that philosophy on Leave Home for the fact that it was actually recorded in a box, but when we recorded at Media Sound, it was a Baptist church for years, for decades. And then when John Roberts and Joel Roseman put together Media Sound with Fred Christie, they utilized the large church area for Studio A. So I put up a couple of, there were probably 67s, I think, or 87s in the room to capture the room sounds. And when I got the multi-tracks back last year, the room sounds just was tremendous. It was great. It was in the Ramones. They're all playing at once. They're, one takes, minimal editing. And we had Johnny separated off with some baffles and Dee Dee in a back room. You could still hear the guitar and bass in the room a little bit, but it was mostly drums. And it sounded tremendous. So the new mix on Rocket to Russia is what we're calling a tracking mix. Mm-hmm. And it's the band. And I based it on those room mics. I brought up the room mics first, then brought the drums in, then brought the guitar in and the bass, and then got that balance of the band live in the studio. There are no guitar overdubs. There's no double tracking of guitars. There's no percussion. There's no backing vocals. And we always double Joey's vocal. And there was usually two or three tracks of Joey's vocal on the multi-track. So I made new comps of Joey's vocal, choosing between the best takes from those two or three tracks that we had. So it's just really the band live in the studio, and it's a great representation of the power of the band during that period. It was also the last record that Tommy played on before he got into producing full time. And it's a tremendous, exciting mix. I really enjoy it. And the fans really love it. I've had so many people come up to me and tell me that they like it so much.
When it comes to the Ramones' legacy, I mean, you're like the last guy that was in the room that's still around to be able to make some of these sonic decisions, I guess. Is there any sort of boundaries or guidance that you have when doing these remixes, like how to keeping the integrity of the band, but maybe not overstepping here and there? Like, what is your internal guidance for those sort of choices you have to make?
My guidance is basically the spirit of the guys behind my back, telling me what to do and suggesting. I worked with them on many records and know them quite well. So I think that they would enjoy what I'm doing on the records. I'm listening to them. I'm getting no feedback from the record companies or the estates on them. I have the freedom of choice to do what I want to do on these. But I'm listening to the guys. I'm listening to Johnny, Dee Dee, Joey, and Tommy saying, hey, this that sounds good, or don't do that, or, you know, it just comes to me. It's, you know, I hired a spiritualist, and he said we're conjuring up, we're having seances, and it's working.
Let me ask you, do their spirits still fight?
Of course they do. But you know what? There was never any fighting in the studio. Never. There was never any problem in the studio. They were there to work. You know, Johnny was had the regiment going for the band. They would go out there and record, and we would take care of business. There was never any arguing or fighting in the studio. That was all done on their own time.
So you just answered the question that they didn't actually fight in the studio, but was there like a palpable feeling about one another? Like, did they communicate that much, or were they together for the purpose of the band and outside of that, not really friendly?
They got along fine until the incident, you know, way later on. You know, it was probably when we recorded End of the Century in 79, I think, mm-hmm. with Spectre. And it was after that, you know, Johnny started having an affair with Linda. And after that, it was, you know, when that broke Joey's heart, mm-hmm. and kind of went to shit after that. Previous to that, I never saw any problems. There's talk of Dee Dee's notorious drug problems, but, you know, I never saw that stuff. Everybody, but apparently, he was doing stuff, but I didn't know anything about it. And everybody was quite normal in the studio and getting along just fine. And, you know, listening back to mixes all together. And, you know, after tracking, you know, Johnny would leave the rest of Tommy and myself to do overdubs, etc., and then come in at the end of the day or in the next day and approve everything. But there was never any infighting in the studio, and I don't think it affected anything.
It sounds like around this time they weren't getting a lot of airplay.
They didn't get any airplay.
Did this concern them?
Oh, they hated that. They wanted to be. They thought they were going to be as popular as they are today. Mm-hmm. Back then, you know, 40 years ago. They were convinced of that. I was convinced of it. Phil Spector was certainly convinced of it. But there was literally no airplay. You know, they had their fan base. A lot, you know, their live shows were widely accepted. They're very popular. But we didn't get any. They didn't get any airplay. They still don't get airplay. I bet. You know, with the exception of the great little Steven Van Zandt's Sirius XM channel. You know, they really started playing, getting radio play. I Want to Be Sedated was the first Ramones song that I ever heard on the radio, and that was on WNEW-FM in New York. But even at NEW, Vince Scalzo, the DJ, New York DJ, famously tells his story about, you know, getting the first Ramones record, putting it on a turntable, and taking it off after about 20 seconds and smashing the record over the air. And saying, what is this piece of crap? What is this piece of shit? Whatever he said, I don't know. He notoriously did that. Of course, later on, he recanted that philosophy and was a huge Ramones fan, even dropping in this recording studio during sessions.
I mean, that's what great art does. It makes people, you know, reassess their thinking. But yeah, and today the Ramones are much more of a cultural touchstone. I mean, the songs are in movies. People just know them. Back then, of course, they weren't. But that must have been tremendously frustrating about not being taken seriously.
They hated it. Mm-hmm. They hated it. They wanted the top 40 hit. You know, they barely squeaked in there.
Was that the reason that drove the decision to approach Phil Spector?
Phil Spector approached the Ramones. Mm. Early on, probably around the time of Leave Home, they played the Whiskey and Phil was there. The Kessel brothers brought Phil to the show. And Phil was pestering the band and Seymour Stein for years to want to produce them. Johnny was always afraid of that. Of course, Joey, it was his dream to be produced by Phil Spector, and it did eventually come true, which was fantastic.
when I think of the career of the Ramones, there's the period before End of the Century and the period after End of the Century. It seems to be like a really big turning point of them. What do you think it was about that album and the process and the result that really changed the band?
It drove everybody crazy. Johnny hated being there. Johnny quit the record at one point after the infamous stint playing that first chord to Rock and Roll High School over and over and over again. Now, let me interject and say that, you know, Johnny did not want to go do the record unless I came along. You know, I didn't produce that record. I didn't even engineer that record. I engineered a couple guitar overdubs that I did. And when I took the masters and, you know, went to another studio with it to do some overdubs, because at that time, you know, after, you know, I gradually started being quote unquote the fifth Ramone, you know, playing, singing backing vocals and, you know, playing guitar on the records. Johnny, you know, had a lot of trust in me. He liked my taste and we got along. We were good friends. And when Seymour finally gave in to Phil to do the record, Johnny wouldn't go unless I was with them. And I credit as musical director on that particular record. I was in the studio with them actually playing guitar on all of the backing tracks. Johnny wanted me to play with him. They, you know, because I was adding parts, especially on Road to Ruin. Added a lot of parts. Tommy and myself did. And Phil was driving us pretty nuts to begin with the continuous playback at incredible volume, playing the songs back, hundreds of times, dozens of times, stopping the tape at excruciating, painful volume. And he'd be stomping on the floor and screaming and swearing. And so when it got to Rock and Roll High School, we were starting off the song with both Johnny and myself hitting a chord and then attaining feedback. We were out in the room right next to the amplifiers. There were just a couple little gobos, baffles, separating, you know, the drums and the amplifiers out in the room. There was no isolation at all. We were all out in the same room. And, you know, we counted off 1, 2, 3, 4 and hit that chord. And then Phil would on and on, do it again. And Phil's in the control room with the great engineer, Larry Levine, Phil's engineer. And, you know, one of the greatest engineers ever to come out of Los Angeles, Grammy winner. He got a Grammy for working with Herb Alpert on Whipped Cream and Other Delights, I believe. The Taste of Honey was on there. So he would be telling, we saw him in the control room jumping up and down and, you know, yelling at Larry, trying to get something going. I don't know what it was. None of us knew what it was. Johnny and I kept looking at each other. Johnny's, you know, rolling his eyes again. We're doing it again. We probably did that for around 2.5 hours, just playing that one chord. Johnny at one point turned that into 8 to 10 hours, which it wasn't. But it was still very difficult to swallow, and not knowing, there was no communication with the control room. We were just out there banging, you know, the cord. I'm out there lighting up cigarette after cigarette going, what the fuck is he doing in there? And Johnny's doing the same thing. And we're all, you know, rolling our eyes. And after that evening, Johnny took me aside and says, I'm leaving. I can't work like this anymore. And it was probably only the fourth or fifth day of recording. And I, you know, called Seymour and told Seymour, Johnny's quitting. He can't work with Phil. This is not working. And Seymour's, you know, you have to make this work. Ed. You have to do something. You have to talk to Phil. You have to talk to Johnny. You got to make this work. We can't drop this. And so, you know, I called Phil. Well, I never really called Phil. I called his assistant, Donna. Then she would call Phil. Then she would call me back and tell me, Phil's going to call you in 10 minutes. Or Phil's going to call you in a half hour. Phil's going to call you back right now. And so I arranged a summit meeting at the Tropicana Hotel, that which used to be the Rock and Roll Hotel. I think it's a parking lot there now, as is Gold Star. Gold Star's not there anymore. There's a parking lot there as well. I think there might be a hotel, some bigger office building where the Tropicana was. But the Tropicana was, you know, had the black pool and all the rock and roll people would stay there. None of the locks worked on the doors. Duke's Cafe was downstairs in the Tropicana. Everybody would go there for breakfast. It was a real cool place. So I set up a meeting for the Ramones and myself and Phil and his bodyguard, George. And we met in Joey's room. And it was searing hot outside, I remember. It was in May or something, but it was ridiculously like 105 degrees out or something. And Joey's room was freezing. And I was the liaison. And Johnny would say to me, "Ed, tell Phil I can't work like this anymore." And I'd look at Phil and go, "Phil, Johnny can't work like this anymore." And then Phil would say to me, "Ed, tell Johnny I'm sorry and I'll change the way I'm working." And then I'd say to Johnny, "Phil's going to change the way he's working. He won't work like this anymore." And it did honestly go on like that. So
turned into an Abbott and Costello routine.
Yeah, it did. I'm trying not to laugh. It was great. And it worked out, everybody, hugged and made up, and we made it through the tracking. And then unfortunately, Johnny's dad passed away like days later, and he had to go back to New York. I don't think he came back after that. Yeah, it was something. It was something.
And that was the start of your reputation as the Henry Kissinger of rock and roll.
That is correct. I don't know who I don't know who coined that term. I didn't do that, but somebody did.
Yeah. So when it comes to End of the Century, obviously that album has such a different sound. Was the band happy with the end result?
Joey was. I think Marky was. Dee Dee didn't care. Johnny hated it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a little strange. Phil apparently mixed that thing three times. And let me say something, Phil really, like I said earlier, when you asked about how do you produce the Ramones, what do you prepare? Well, Phil didn't do anything either. We were rehearsing at SIR, and he came in the last day of rehearsal. He came in. We were all excited that Phil was coming. I was totally excited that Phil was coming. I had met him a couple days earlier at Gold Star when he was working with the Paley brothers. And he didn't change anything to the Ramones, which, like I said earlier, you shouldn't change anything. It's the band. It's what they are. So Phil didn't do anything with the arrangements or any suggestions or in any guidance whatsoever. He just recorded them and put a lot of hand claps on there and a lot of reverb. Mm-hmm. But there was no changes in the arrangements. I was there. I was there for every minute of the recording. And with the vocals, I was there with Joey doing the vocals, and Phil would just do like three or four takes of Joey doing vocals, and that was it. There was a lot of time spent in between the takes. He would do his Phil thing. He didn't do much to the actual recording itself. He double-tracked some drums. He put acoustic guitars on everything. Johnny and I played acoustic guitars on every song. Maybe when I get the multi-tracks to work on that for the box set, I'll see if there are in fact acoustic, but I remember playing acoustic guitars on everything, both Johnny and myself.
Do you ever think we'll see a version of End of the Century without the Phil Spector sound, kind of like Let It Be Naked? Will there be an End of the Century Naked?
There will be.
Ah, brilliant.
Yes. Yeah. Unleashed. I don't know what they're going to call it.
Okay.
For 2019, I believe.
Ah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Now, you mentioned you play on a lot of the Ramones stuff, and I think that started around Road to Ruin.
It started back on Leave Home.
Oh, okay.
There's little bits and pieces that I played on Leave Home. There's stuff on Rocket to Russia that I played, but there's a lot of it on Road to Ruin, yes.
Are you the first person, or perhaps only person other than the Ramones, to play on a Ramones record?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, for sure. Tommy played some stuff on the first record, I think. Mm-hmm. I wasn't around for the first record, but Tommy played a few little things. When I joined the band for Leave Home, you know, I started doing little dribs and drabs. And like I said, by the time I got to Road to Ruin, you know, I was really a member of the band. I was part of the club. And Johnny was a specialist. He did what he did and would suggest that I do these little parts. Can you do this? Can you do that? Or I would come up with ideas, or Tommy would come up with ideas. And of course, all of these ideas, he didn't care to, you know, play the other bits. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to do that. So he relinquished the job to myself and Tommy. And they were all, you know, we would put down stuff. Sometimes it would be Johnny approved, and other things wouldn't be Johnny approved. We're just branching out a little bit, making it more of a record, more of a recording.
But there was no insecurity from the band, or particularly from Johnny, about someone else coming in and doing guitar parts?
Absolutely not. No, he wanted me to do them.
Okay.
Yeah, it was at his request. And I just, you know, and then I just fell into it. You know, I just started playing. And, you know, by the time it got to the end of the century, I was playing in the band on all the tracking dates.
When it comes to the album It's Alive, how much is actually live and how much is overdubs?
I don't remember. There might have been some fixes in there. Mm-hmm. May have been a couple fixes, but not much. It's pretty alive.
Okay.
We probably like spotted a couple, you know, DD probably went off here and there, probably fixed that up, try to match that up. And there's a couple little things, but, you know, all the drums are, you know, for sure, solid all the way through. Didn't fix any drums. And we probably just spotted some vocal stuff and guitar and bass here and there. So I would say 95% of that is live.
Wow. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
There's the rumor is that it's 95% not. So that's interesting to know. Will there be an It's Alive 40th anniversary version coming out as well?
There'll be something coming out. I'm not sure. I would like to do a new mix. There's also a film that was a film company filmed that thing. So I would like to do a Blu-ray out on that with the 5.1 mix. I think that'll be great. And I'd like to do a new mix on it, just to get a little bit more definition on everything. You know, with all of these box sets, we keep the original mixes as well and remaster them. Mm-hmm. Greg Calvi has been doing that at Sterling Sound. So we do have, it's not like we're redoing everything. We have the original and the new version, and a lot of extra treats as well.
Are all the tapes accounted for? All the multi-tracks, all the masters, everything?
Everything is accounted for. They're all in the Warner Brothers vault. The only thing that we couldn't find is the multi-track for Sheena and I Don't Care. That somehow, the last time I saw it, it was at Power Station. We mixed. That was the first project to be done at Power Station, was mixing Rocket to Russia. And we remixed Sheena and I Don't Care for the Rocket to Russia record. Mm-hmm. And that's the last time that I saw that multi-track. It was 16-track, recorded at Sundragon. And it's gone missing. Somebody has it somewhere. It was at Power Station, but somehow it didn't get sent back with the Rocket to Russia masters to Warner Brothers. But they have everything. Bill Inglot, my associate and co-producer on the box sets, has been incredible at finding stuff and, you know, pulling together all the multi-tracks and the master mixes and the demos and all sorts of crazy shit that he finds. Unbelievable. He found this version of Needles and Pins that we put on the Rocket to Russia box set that was recorded during that same period. I don't know. He thought I recorded it. I didn't record it. I don't know where it came from. He doesn't even know where it came from. It was like a fan had a cassette of it somewhere. Oh. But it's pretty cool.
Interesting. So you're getting these multi-track boxes, opening them up for perhaps the first time in, you know, 35, 40 years, finding the notes, the track sheets, any interesting artifacts you found in while doing these projects?
Well, like I said, the two songs that we recorded for Rocket mm-hmm. to Russia that were never released, that's pretty cool. But not, it's just, you know, the track sheets are there. Nothing surprised me. You know, things like on Ramona, on Rocket Through Russia. I didn't realize that there was an extra verse in there that we cut out for the master. And there's a bunch of harmonies on there. And so I made a new mix of that, different than the tracking mix, but encompassing. It had an extra verse with different lyrics.
Yeah, but no lyric sheets, no, you know, menus no. for Chinese food, no.
No, nope, nothing like that. I just, and Warner Brothers has all that stuff, so I get it on, in a Pro Tools file, and then they send me, PDFs of the track sheets, etc. So there's some coffee stains on the track sheets, but no residual marijuana seeds or anything in the boxes, because I didn't get the boxes, because, you know, notoriously, tape boxes were used for cleaning weed back in the day.
Yeah, we were talking to the guys with that do the Queen archive, and they when they went back to the master boxes, they found all sorts of stuff: lyric sheets, ideas, sketches, drawing, that sort of thing. So,
that's cool.
It always fascinates me, the time capsule type approach of some of these multi-track boxes.
Yeah, you know, as far as I know, there could have been some of that stuff in there, but I actually did not see or touch the boxes. I just have PDFs.
So after End of the Century, the band starts to fragment quite a bit more. What was your involvement from Sweet Dreams through Adios Amigos?
Pleasant Dreams, it was.
Oh, sorry. Pleasant Dreams.
No worries. I worked on the... the Rock and Roll High School songs, we did that before End of the Century. After End of the Century, they went off. They worked with Graham Gulman on Pleasant Dreams, and then with John Beauvoir. And then they did bring Tommy and I back for, I did demos for Pleasant Dreams, actually, at Daily Planet, New York. And I wish those multi-tracks were, this is funny. Johnny was a real spendthrift. So they had one reel of 2-inch tape, which they would do demos on at 15 IPS for every record. But then they would erase them and go on to the next one. Yeah. So I asked Monty Melnick, their tour manager, "Hey John, Monty, do you happen to know where that 2-inch tape is? Because it was in their possession." And he didn't have any idea, but at that time he told me, "Yeah, we used to use that the same tape over and over again for every record." So, you know, the multi-tracks were always erased because Johnny didn't want to spend the money to get any more tape. Yeah, but I do have, I don't even have quarter inches of that stuff. I have cassette copies, which we'll probably pull. We have pulled actually in the past for some of the earlier Ramones reissues. There's some... the demos for End of the Century were from my cassette, and there's some other things for the Graham Gulman Pleasant Dreams record that the demos that I did, they're pulled from cassette as well. But so I did the demos for that, and then, you know, they did their thing. They went on, you know, trying other producers, John Beauvoir, Daniel Ray. But Tommy and I did come back, I guess it was in 1983. No, I think it was 1984 for Too Tough to Die. When Marky was not in the group anymore, and Richie, the great Richie Ramone, was now playing drums, and that's a fan favorite. You know, honestly, you know, some of the records, in my opinion, just did not live up to the standard that the first three records had. The first three records are the triptych, I'm supposed to say, the triptych of the Ramones. Those first three records, they're just fantastic. Every song is great. There's not a bad one in the bunch. Great spirit on those records. And after End of the Century, we still had that spirit, but you know, it kind of dissipated during the making of End of the Century, and then after that, with the troubles with the relationships, etc., the spirit lived on, but not as it did on the first three records. And so Tommy and I did come back for End of the Century, and that was great to be reunited with the guys. And I was always in touch with Joey and Johnny. We would talk, you know, a few times a year, even when I wasn't working with them. And also, you know, to the end with both of them, we were friends. And you know, didn't wasn't that much in touch with Dee Dee. Richie, I still see occasionally. Marky, I don't see at all. And then, you know, if they went on to, you know, several other records. Then I came back to do Mondo Bizarro in the 90s with them, which I thought was a great record. And there's some good songs on there. Johnny wasn't a big fan of the record. Of course, Joey loved every record that they did, every one of them. It was he loved them. He was a real, what a spirit, what a great spirit Joey is.
We had CJ on the show, and he was talking about you know, being in the band at that time and seeing what he felt were the band making some pretty bad choices. At one point, they had the option to sign to Epitaph, and Epitaph was ready to roll out the red carpet and to invest heavy and get them to, you know, have a Ramones album that they could really be proud of, a legacy-setting album. But they decided not to go with that. In that era of the band, it seems very fragmented. Their music is so much fun, but their interviews are always very angry and sad. Is that really the ending of the Ramones? Is that really the story of the Ramones? Or do you think there's much more to tell about the band?
I think that's a story. I mean, did you see that there was a documentary, End of the Century?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That pretty much tells the story right there. It's kind of tragic in the end. Especially with all of them gone now, it's extremely tragic. It's sad, tragic, and they're not seeing the success that they have right now.
They all died so early, too.
Yeah. Oh, just terrible. And it's, you know, people, you know, call it the curse of the Ramones. You know, I talk to Monty once in a while, and he goes, well, I hope we're not next. It's just, you know, Arturo Vega, their lighting director, passed away. Linda Stein, their early co-manager with Danny Field, was murdered in her apartment in New York. One of their accountants, I forgot the accountant's name, also passed away. Gary Kerfers, their manager, passed away while he was at his place in the Bahamas.
You may be a Highlander.
Yeah, I think I am. I've got a couple brushes, you know. I had, well, one big brush. You know, I miss being on the Lockerbie, the bombed Pan Am 103 because I didn't finish a project and stayed on to working instead of getting on the plane.
Truly.
With
truly.
True story with my engineer, Paul Hammingson. So that was my brush. There's probably a couple other ones.
Were you involved at all in the Dee Dee Ramone rap album?
No.
Okay. No. There's another one.
But I love once in a while when I'm in a really shitty mood, I will put up that whatever that song is, that funky 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 funky. It's unbelievable. It's so funny. It's perfect. I mean, what else? Dee Dee Ramone is a rapper, the great white rapper. Dee Dee Ramone. Dee Dee King. It wasn't even Dee Dee Ramone. He changed his name.
Dee Dee King. What was your reaction when you heard about that? Similar to what you just had.
A little flabbergasted. And they're what the. Dee Dee, what are you dressing like that for? He started dressing like a rapper, you know. Well, he's, you know, rapper clothes, you know, inner city, you know, the sweatsuit, sweatpants, and, you know, gold chains and shit, and little hats. It was funny. It makes me laugh. It cracks me up. It's, you know, it's very cheerful. Funky, 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 funky.
That is actually quite a collectible record now. If people can find that Dee Dee King rap album, it's, 150, 200 bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, Ed, I want to be respectful of your time and love to have you back on at some point to talk about some of the other projects you've done. I mean, you've worked with Mick Jagger, of course, Talking Heads, Living Color, the Sugar Ponies. You know,
let's not forget the Smithereens.
Oh, yes. Rest in peace, Pat.
Rest in peace, Pat. We just did a nice participated in a wonderful tribute in New Jersey last weekend. We did at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank. A lot of people showed up. It was a lot of love and tears in the room. It was really fantastic. But what a going to miss that guy.
What a great band.
I'm going to miss him knocking at my door. Well, when I was living in Los Angeles, Pat would always show up at unpredictably at any time, whether it be sometimes at midnight or, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, bearing gifts. Very funny guy. One of a kind. One in a gazillion. And great, great songwriter. Fantastic voice. A voice that can melt an iceberg.
Do we think you'll see a project on the Smithereens? Any remixes of some of their stuff?
I don't think so. I don't think any. Those records sound great. The Don Dixon records are great. I really like the records I did. I wouldn't see any reason for doing any new mixes on those. You know, unless 5.1 catches on, right?
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah. Real quick, I just want to draw people's attention to the 40th anniversary editions of Rocket to Russia and Leave Home. And it sounds like there's some other cool stuff on the way. Of course, you could find out about all the stuff that Ed's up to for the Ramones at Ramones.com. Ed, anything else you want to share with the Vinyl Guide crew?
Well, thanks for contacting me, Nate. And yes, thanks to Suzanne Kramer and the Sugar Pony, only Suzanne only, whatever she's calling herself.
Just Suzanne.
Great gal.
How did you guys get involved with Sugar Ponies? I never heard that story.
We had a mutual friend. I went to the same high school as Michael, a decade apart, mind you, or so. But we all attended Dunellen High School in Dunellen, New Jersey. And there was a music critic and writer for the Courier News, used to be the Plainfield Courier News when I was a kid, Central New Jersey newspaper called the Courier News. Her name is Lynn Jackson. And Michael got a hold of her. She was in the same class as Michael, and Michael got a hold of her and played her the what they had been working on. And she says, "You need help on this, buddy." And I know just the guy. So, Michael and Suzanne contacted me and sent me the stuff, and I said, "Yeah, this is fun. We can do something together. Let's fix it up." Hmm. So, there was a lot of stuff already existing, and I kind of took over the reins and helped them through to, as I always say, bring their vision to fruition as well as I can. As well as I can. I try to do my best.
Well, it sounds, and I've heard the work you've done with Sugar Ponies, fantastic. Draw everyone's attention there, sugarponies.com, even though I think they are now officially no longer Sugar Ponies. It is just Suzanne, several side projects. But anyway, Ed, thanks again for spending time with us here on The Vinyl Guide. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Nate. Thanks for your interest. I appreciate your interest. Yes, indeed.
No worries. Right, Ed, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide and sharing with us all about those years with the Ramones. Absolutely fascinating. Ed's had this incredible career. I tell you what, go to edstasium.com. Look at his discography. It just scrolls and scrolls and scrolls. It's a whole list of just, it's like a who's who of awesome music. It's like, oh, he worked on that album and that album too. It just keeps going. He's been involved with so many great acts. I know today we just talked about the Ramones. We got to have Ed back on to talk about all sorts of other projects he's been involved into outside of the Ramones. There's only so much time we can really do these for. So we hope to have him back on soon. Also want to make sure people know about the Ramones 40th anniversary deluxe editions, both of Rocket to Russia, Leave Home, and some other ones coming out. Make sure you check those out at Ramones.com. Those Ed Stasium mixes, they sound brilliant. So make sure to check those out. All right, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. We've got a bunch of great episodes coming out, so make sure you keep your subscription settings set to The Vinyl Guide. Share with your friends. Help them get involved with The Vinyl Guide. Show them how to download our app from the Apple App Store or Google Play or whatever so they don't miss a single episode. And of course, you can get all 110 plus episodes on those apps at any time. All righty, well, until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.